Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really interesting property law puzzle, courtesy of the Rhode Island Supreme Court. The 2013 case Caliore v. Dexter Credit Union. Have you ever wondered when, like, using your neighbor's property for years could actually give you a legal right to keep doing it, even without their permission?
Yeah.
That's pretty much the core of what we're digging into today.
Exactly. And this case is a fantastic lens, really, to examine how courts try to balance the rights of property owners with, you know, the realities of long-term land use.
Right.
We've got a great set of materials to work with, some podcast-specific analysis, a detailed breakdown, a more concise summary, and even a look at some of the complexities.
Okay. So our mission in this deep dive is to really get a handle on the difference between two key ways these kinds of property rights can pop up. Prescriptive easements, which are essentially earned through long, unopposed use, and implied easements, which are rooted more in how a property was originally divided up.
Right, the history.
Exactly. We'll be unpacking the specific facts of the Caliore case and the court's reasoning to give, hopefully, a clear picture of these concepts. Okay, so let's just jump right in. What's the situation here? What's the story behind this driveway dispute?
Okay, so the case centers on two neighboring pieces of land in Scituate, Rhode Island. You've got Cynthia Caliore owning one lot, Lot 18, and then Dexter Credit Union later acquires the adjacent Lot 19 back in 2010.
Okay.
Now, here's the crucial bit. For decades, literally decades, Caliore and her tenants had been using this paved driveway that was actually located on Dexter Credit Union's property, Lot 19, to get to and park on her land, Lot 18.
Huh. Even though it wasn't technically hers.
Exactly. And interestingly, when Caliore bought her property way back in 1981, the deed, the paperwork, specifically excluded this driveway from her property lines.
Why?
So legally, it was never hers on paper.
Okay, so she's been using her neighbor's land for what sounds like a significant amount of time, decades, you said, even though it wasn't part of her original purchase. That definitely sounds like it could, you know, lead to a claim for a prescriptive easement.
Absolutely. It's got all the initial makings of one. Then fast forward to 2010, Dexter Credit Union buys Lot 19 and decides they want to develop the land.
Oh, okay.
And their plans involve moving the existing driveway and basically cutting off Caliore's access to it.
Which, naturally, she wouldn't be happy about.
Not at all. So this leads to Caliore filing a lawsuit in 2011, arguing that she had established legal rights to use that driveway through both a prescriptive easement and an implied easement.
Okay, trying both avenues. And what did the initial court, the trial court, say about all this?
Well, after the trial, the Superior Court actually sided with Dexter Credit Union. They rejected both of Caliore's arguments.
Both, though.
Yeah. They concluded that Caliore hadn't sufficiently demonstrated that her use of the driveway was, quote, hostile or under a claim of right. And they also weren't convinced that her use was notorious enough. And they also didn't find enough evidence to support her claim for an implied easement either. So a complete shutdown initially.
But that wasn't the final word, was it? I gather the Rhode Island Supreme Court then stepped in.
Yes, exactly. Caliore appealed the Superior Court's decision, and the Supreme Court actually partially reversed it.
Partially. Interesting.
Yeah. They sent the prescriptive easement issue back down to the lower court for another look, but they agreed with the trial court's denial of the implied easement claim.
All right, let's really dig into these two types of easements then, because that distinction seems crucial. Starting with prescriptive easements, if someone wants to claim a right to use a neighbor's property this way, what are the essential legal boxes they have to tick? What's the test?
Okay, so in Rhode Island, the requirements to establish a prescriptive easement are quite specific, and they actually mirror those in many other states. The person claiming the easement, Caliore, in this case, has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that their use of the property was actual, open, notorious, hostile, and continuous for at least 10 years.
10 years, okay.
10 years. And each of those elements, actual, open, notorious, hostile, continuous, is crucial. You got to hit all five.
Okay. Actual use and continuous use seem pretty, well, self-explanatory. She was physically using the driveway regularly for that period. But open, notorious, and especially hostile, those sound like they have some pretty particular legal meanings that might not be what we'd assume in everyday chat.
You're absolutely right. That's often where the confusion comes in. Open and notorious essentially mean that the use must be visible and obvious enough that a reasonable property owner would have noticed it if they were paying attention.
Okay, so not sneaking around.
Right. It's about putting the owner, on what the law calls constructive notice. You know, they should have known. Now, hostile, that's the big one.
Yeah.
In a legal context, it doesn't mean there's necessarily any fighting or, like, bad blood involved.
Right, not animosity.
No. Instead, hostile simply means that the use was without the owner's permission. It's about using the property as if you have the right to, regardless of what the owner actually wants or thinks. Think of it as just a lack of consent.
Okay, so using it like it's yours, without asking.
Precisely. And the related concept, under a claim of right, basically means the same thing. The person using the property is acting as if they have a legitimate right to do so, not like they're trespassing and hoping not to get caught.
That's a really important distinction about hostile. So it's less about being aggressive and much more about the use happening without permission. Now, how did the Supreme Court look at these elements in Calori's case, especially since the trial court had ruled against her on hostility and notoriety?
Yeah, this is where the Supreme Court's analysis gets really interesting and highlights some potential errors in how these cases can be decided initially. On the issue of hostility, the Supreme Court pointed out a significant error by the trial court.
What was that?
The lower court had actually referred to something called a notice of intent to dispute as a factor in their decision.
Okay.
But the Supreme Court emphasized that this document was never actually presented as evidence during the trial.
Oh, you can't do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A court can't base its findings on things that aren't part of the official record. So that consideration just got tossed out.
Right.
Then, looking at the actual evidence that was presented, the Supreme Court noted that Caliori and her tenants had been using this driveway consistently since the 1980s.
Decades.
And had never asked for or received permission to do so. The Supreme Court reasoned that this pattern of use, acting as if they had the right to use the driveway without seeking consent, could indeed satisfy the element of hostility.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, if you're just using someone's property openly and regularly for decades without ever acknowledging their ownership or asking, hey, is this okay? It certainly looks like you're acting as if it's your right to do so.
Precisely.
Okay, what about the notorious use? The trial court didn't think her use was obvious enough.
Right, and the Supreme Court also disagreed with the trial court on this point as well. They emphasized that Calori's use of the driveway wasn't some hidden or, you know, occasional thing.
It was a driveway.
It was a driveway. Her residential tenants used it. Commercial deliveries for a building she later added to her property used it. People parked on it all visibly and consistently with how one would typically use a driveway to access a property.
Right, normal driveway use.
Exactly. The Supreme Court reasoned that this kind of regular open use over such a long period should have been enough to put the actual owner on constructive notice of Calori's adverse claim. The standard isn't whether the owner actually knew every single time, but whether the use was so apparent that a reasonable owner should have known what was going on.
So the Supreme Court was essentially saying, look, this wasn't some secret path through the woods. She was using it openly, like a normal driveway, in a way that indicated she believed she had a right to for a very, very long time. That should have put the owner on notice.
You got it. And the Supreme Court clarified that hostility doesn't require some sort of, like, confrontation or explicit statement like, this is mine.
Right.
It's about the absence of permission and using the property in a way that's inconsistent with the true owner's rights. The trial court, in the Supreme Court's view, had kind of incorrectly interpreted the legal meaning of hostility.
It's a good reminder that legal terms often have very specific definitions that can differ quite a bit from everyday language.
Definitely. And for a property owner, this really highlights the importance of being aware of how your property is being used,
right,
even if you aren't actively objecting at every single moment. Allowing continuous open use without permission can have legal consequences down the line. You can't just ignore it for decades and then suddenly say, stop.
Okay, that really clarifies the prescriptive easement side of the case. And the fact that it was sent back down suggests the Supreme Court thought there was a real possibility, maybe even a likelihood, that a prescriptive easement could be established under the correct legal framework.
Yes, they definitely saw enough evidence for hostility and notoriety that it needed a second look by the trial court using the right legal standards.
Okay. Now let's switch gears and talk about the other claim. Implied easements. Why did the Supreme Court agree with the lower court in denying that claim? What's different there?
The legal requirements for an implied easement are quite different. Generally, an implied easement arises when a larger piece of property is divided into two or more smaller parcels.
Okay, the split.
Right, the severance. And the prior use of one part of the property for the benefit of another part was apparent, continuous, and reasonably necessary for the enjoyment of the newly divided parcel.
Reasonably necessary.
Reasonably necessary. But the absolute key element here is that this necessity and the prior use must have existed at the time the property was originally divided or severed.
Ah, timing is everything there.
Crucial.
And when did that severance happen in Calorie's situation?
The critical moment of severance, the division, was back in 1981. That's when the previous owner, Dorothy Feeney, sold Lot 18 to Calorie.
Okay.
At that specific time, the deed explicitly excluded the driveway, as we mentioned, and Lot 19, which contained the driveway, remained under separate ownership. That's the moment we look at for implied easements.
So what was the sticking point with the reasonably necessary requirement at that specific point in time back in 1981? Why wasn't it necessary then?
Well, the Supreme Court sided with the trial court's finding on this. They found that Calorie hadn't adequately demonstrated that the driveway was reasonably necessary for the enjoyment of Lot 18 in 1981.
But didn't she build a commercial building later? Wouldn't that make it necessary?
Ah, yes, but that's the key. While it's true that the driveway likely became more convenient and perhaps even arguably necessary after Calorie built a commercial building on her property in 1983,
right,
that later development doesn't factor into the analysis of an implied easement. The law looks strictly at the necessity as it existed at the precise moment the properties were divided in 1981.
Okay, so what happened later is irrelevant for this type of claim.
Exactly. Because the commercial building and its increased parking demands came after the 1981 conveyance, they couldn't be used to argue that the driveway was a reasonable necessity back then when the lots were first separated.
Ah, okay. So even though the driveway became much more important for her property's functionality later on, because it wasn't deemed essential for the basic use of Lot 18 back in 1981 when the properties became separate entities, the implied easement claim failed. It really underscores how critical the timing of that necessity is for implied easements.
Absolutely. The court's reasoning really emphasizes that implied easements are fundamentally about trying to understand the presumed intentions of the original property owner when they split the land.
Like, what do they assume would happen?
Right. What was so obviously necessary for the use of the piece of property being sold at that specific time that it was sort of implied, understood to be included with the sale, even if it wasn't explicitly written down in the deed. In Calorie's case, the court just didn't find that level of necessity existed back in 1981 based on the evidence presented. It's a much narrower and more time-sensitive claim than a prescriptive easement, which looks at behavior over a long period.
Okay, so just to recap the really key takeaways, maybe condense them down.
Yeah.
Especially regarding prescriptive easements from this case. It boils down to proving that actual, open, notorious, hostile, and continuous use for at least 10 years.
Right. Clear and convincing evidence.
And the court made it clear that ordinary, visible use can be enough to establish notoriety. And crucially, that hostility simply means using the property without the owner's permission, not necessarily fighting.
Yep. Lack of consent is key for hostility.
And maybe a procedural point, but a critical one.
Mm-hmm.
Courts have to base their decisions on the evidence that is actually presented during the trial, not stuff they heard about elsewhere.
Absolutely fundamental. Can't use evidence not in the record.
Okay. And then for implied easements, the big lesson from Calorie is that the necessity for the easement, that reasonable necessity, has to exist at the exact moment the property is divided or severed.
That moment in time.
Later changes in circumstances or how the property is used won't retroactively create an implied easement.
Correct. It's all about that point of severance.
Okay, so for me, the real aha moment here, the thing that clicks, is understanding that fundamental difference in focus between the two. Prescriptive easements are all about a pattern of long-term behavior on the land, how it's been used over time.
The actions.
Whereas implied easements are all about that specific point in time when the property lines were first drawn and what was reasonably necessary for the use of the newly created parcel then.
You've absolutely hit the nail on the head. That's the core distinction. One is about the evolution of land use over time, potentially creating a new right, kind of earning it through action. And the other is about the presumed intent and the necessary dependencies that existed right at the moment of property division.
This case really makes you think, doesn't it? About properties in your own neighborhood or, you know, just stories you hear about disputes over shared driveways or paths or strips of land.
Oh, yeah.
Based on what we've discussed today, you start wondering, what kind of easement if any, might be in play in those situations. Yeah. What specific facts about the history of the land use and the original property division would be the most crucial to figure out the likely legal outcome?
Exactly.
Kaluri v. Dexter Credit Union really highlights how property law often comes down to these very specific, sometimes nuanced details about past actions, past intentions, and precise timing.
It certainly does, and it kind of encourages a deeper look, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Not just at the current situation on the ground, but the whole history of how that situation came to be.
Yeah.
It's a good reminder that what might seem like a pretty straightforward neighborly issue using a driveway can actually have surprisingly complex legal underpinnings rooted in both long-term usage patterns and the historical division of the property itself.
So maybe a provocative thought to leave listeners with. Mm-hmm. Consider properties, you know, maybe even your own. If there's use of adjacent land, what questions would you ask now? Would you focus on how long it's been happening and whether permission was ever given? That's your prescriptive easement lens.
Uh-huh.
Or would you be digging into the deeds, trying to figure out when the properties were divided and what was essential back then? That's your implied easement angle. This case shows both matter, but for very different reasons. It really emphasizes that property rights aren't always as clear-cut as the lines on a map might suggest.
Well said. And think about the implications, too. For property owners today, how vigilant do you need to be about uses on your land to prevent a prescriptive easement from arising down the road? Do you need to formally grant permission or actively object?
Good point.
And for potential buyers, how crucial is it to really understand the history of property lines and access, not just the current use, when you're making a purchase? These are definitely some of the practical questions this kind of case raises.